Welcome to the edge of the world, the Murmansk region, where the Arctic's raw beauty and frigid climate provide unique opportunities for some extreme adventures. Here, if you're lucky, you'll see the Northern Lights dance across the night sky while the waves of the Arctic Barents Sea crash on the shore below. Join us as we take a deep dive into the wonders of the North. Perched on the edge of the Russian Arctic, Teribirka is a place where land meets the raw power of the water. Here, the Barents Sea crashes against the rocky shores, molding landscapes over millennia. Denise, are we really at the edge of the world now? What happens if we go further north?
If we go further north, we'll reach the Barents Sea, then Franz Josef Land, and just a little further, the North Pole. We really are on the edge of the world.
Well, it certainly feels like it.
Yes, so you can change the show's name from Inland Visions to In Sea Visions.
In Sea Visions. Well,
yeah. Or In Ocean Visions.
It's certainly, yes, appropriate name. But it's the Barents Sea is renowned for the severity of its storms. What makes the storms so brutal here? And have you experienced one?
Of course I have. For starters, I was born here, in the north. Ever since I was small, I can remember gusts of wind reaching 40 meters per second or more. I've also experienced hurricanes and severe storms at sea, with waves battering the boat from both sides. It got so bad once that our engine gave out and the emergency lights came on. But we managed to restart it quickly and continued on our way. Winds and storms here can have formidable power. They shouldn't be taken lightly.
It's considered to be one of the cleanest seas, with the water here circulating every 4 years or so, compared to maybe 10 to 15 years in other seas. Why is that? Why does the water circulate so frequently?
I've brought a map of the Barents Sea, Peter. I'll send you a digital copy later. It shows the circulation of its waters. It shows that the sea is open on several sides, which is why it has such a short circulation period. It takes the Barents Sea just 5.9 years to replace its water entirely, because you have warm water from the Atlantic coming in from the west and cold Arctic water coming in from the north.
Now, it's also a popular northern diving spot. Say I was to put my scuba gear on and dive in right now, what would I see?
You'd see a lot of interesting stuff. So you can see kelp forests, schools of fish. As I said before, the Barents Sea is so fertile because of a number of factors, such as the shape of its coastline, deep trenches and water circulation. It receives warm and more saline water from the Gulf Stream. When it reaches Arctic water, it forms a frontal zone, which helps create oases of abundant life around shallow area sandbanks. That makes it a prime region for fisheries.
Denise, you mentioned the Kamchatka crab can be found here. Now, my geography's not great, but I can tell you that we're a long way from Kamchatka. How on earth did it end up here? Because I'm pretty sure it didn't crawl all the way.
This is a great environment for the Kamchatka crab. And ideas to introduce it here emerged as far back as the 1930s. They had to be put on the back burner because of the war and were only revisited in the 1950s. In 1960, the acclimatization of the species began. Our institute also took part. Adult Kamchatka crab, young animals and larvae would be brought here and released at several points along the Kola Peninsula coastline. At first, nothing happened and the experiment was considered a failure. In fact, though, the acclimatization process continued and the first Kamchatka crab specimens were discovered here in 1973 or 74. That's when we realized it was still around. Their numbers grew. When the warm climate period began in the late 1980s, which we're still experiencing today, Kamchatka crab larvae found themselves in a very favorable environment and began to thrive. 10 to 12 years later, by the start of the 2000s, they fully matured, and we saw a boom in numbers. These waters are now abundant with Kamchatka crab. It basically acclimatized itself to the Barents Sea and has even spread west to the Norwegian Sea.
And what impact has it had on the ecology here?
It certainly has had an impact on the native species which it preys upon. However, the ecosystem has rebalanced itself. It just can't remain out of balance. The Kamchatka crab is now a precious bioresource that's protected by law and commercially fished in the Barents Sea.
Obviously, we're above the Arctic Circle now, and winters can bring a month of complete darkness. Is it true that the wildlife here is reinvigorated with the first rays of light when they penetrate through the sea?
30 years ago, scientists imagined that life underwater, especially plankton, just sort of froze during the polar nights, with nothing much going on. However, back in the 1990s, our scientists used data collected from under the ice sheet of the Kara Sea during the polar nights and discovered that plankton continues to grow. Not as actively as the light season, of course, but it still kept developing. There are many things underwater we still don't know about, and more research is needed, primarily by means of conducting these field measurements. When we're at sea, we can see something, feel something, etc. Satellites can't tell us the whole story. You need to be here physically. And I suggest that you and I now do a little hands-on research.
Really, so I can play my own role in studying the Barents Sea. Let's try it.
Peter, this is the 1968 color scale.
Oh my God.
And this is the disc used to measure water transparency. It's also known as a Secchi disc. It's the simplest and oldest instrument for measuring water clarity.
I'm scared to hold it.
And now we're going to measure the transparency of the Barents Sea at this point.
The Arctic is a land of extremes, and some adventurers push the limits of what's humanly possible. We catch up with a group of surfers, yes, you heard that right, surfers, who take on the icy sea swells. Alexander, I guess my first question has to be, have you completely lost your mind? Why on earth would you surf here and not somewhere a bit warmer?
When I get into the water, my thoughts dissolve. But it's not because I'm losing my mind, but because it's so beautiful and interesting around here. Cold water surfing is a unique experience. It's very different from surfing in warm water. If you have a surf like this and don't get in, I think it's a crime.
And how is it different?
The main difference is that you're wearing a thick wetsuit, which restricts your movement. But the waves here are real. They lift you up. They're really playful and interesting. You do get cold sometimes, but it's worth it.
So is this wetsuit really enough to keep you warm in such cold temperatures? And I can see your face is exposed as well. How do you protect your face?
Some surfers use special lotions, but we don't usually do that. The conditions here are not so harsh. It doesn't get colder than minus 12 or minus 13 degrees Celsius, and the water temperature is usually above zero. As long as you keep moving in your wetsuit, you're not going to get cold. The most important rule of cold water surfing is to always keep moving. Then you won't freeze.
And are there any sort of procedures or rituals that you go through before you go surfing to prepare your body for such cold temperatures?
You definitely need to warm up. It's much more important for cold water conditions than for surfing in warm water. It's also necessary because the wetsuit restricts your movement, and you need to be physically fit. You need to exercise and have a healthy lifestyle. The healthier your lifestyle, the easier it is for you to handle cold water surfing.
I bet, because you must spend a lot of energy
surfing, the physical act of surfing, but I bet your body also expends a lot of energy just keeping warm in the water.
Not that much, actually. The key thing, again, is to keep moving. If your body produces heat, your wetsuit will retain it. If you're not producing heat, you'll get cold. You expend more energy keeping warm. That's why you have to eat a lot before surfing.
But not too much.
Right, not too much, but stock up on energy so that it's enough for a surfing session. We sometimes surf for 2 or 3 hours straight in cold water without any issues.
Amazing, amazing. Now, the Barents Sea, it's known for its severe conditions, its storms, its big waves. How big can the waves get here? And I guess that must be an opportunity for you.
The waves today aren't very big, but it's a great surf because the wave shape is ideal. We can ride waves that are up to 1.5 times your height at the spot. It's about 3 meters. When the waves get bigger, the currents become too strong. You can still surf, but you need to be a top-notch surfer to stay on top. We're probably not at that level yet, but we've been successfully riding 3-meter waves here.
Incredible. And I know that you don't just surf in the daytime, you also surf at night as well. Now, to me, ice-cold water, pitch-black conditions, it sounds like a recipe for disaster. How do you keep your bearings in those sort of surfing conditions?
We know the spot very well, so it's hard to get lost here. It's a closed-off bay, so you don't lose your bearings even with strong currents. You just need to know what to do and in which direction to paddle, and you'll be fine. We don't surf that often at night, but we have a great advantage here, which is polar day. When the sun never sets, you can pick any time of the day or night to go surfing. We don't surf as much in winter because it's darker, and we surf more frequently in summertime because we can pick
24 hours a day
any time we like.
Can you describe to me the experience of surfing at night? What do you get from that that you can't get during the day?
When you're surfing at dusk, you can't see waves approaching from afar. You only see it when it's right next to you. That requires greater focus. You rely less on your vision and more on your other senses. You can't obviously ride big waves at night, but with enough moonlight, smaller waves are quite discernible. And you can catch waves at dusk or even when the moon shines bright to add some variety to your surfing routine.
Amazing. Well, Alexander, thanks so much for explaining to me why on earth you'd go surfing here in the Arctic. I won't get in your way anymore, and I'll let you catch some waves. Спасибо. Thank you very much.
Спасибо большое. See you on the waves.
Here, beyond the Arctic Circle, people once hunted bears to survive. But tonight, our hunt is for something far more spectacular. Alexander, we've embarked upon our hunt for the Northern Lights. How do we even start looking for them?
It all starts even before our guests arrive. There are different types of forecasts, but the best one is the one we do ourselves. Satellite systems beam certain data to ground stations, and there are publicly accessible websites where you can find the data. In addition, there are ground stations which measure shifts in the magnetic field, while satellites track flows that come from the sun. After analyzing the data several days in advance, we double-check everything on the day. We also monitor weather conditions and pick a day when everything falls into place for our outing. We choose a direction too, say northward or southward, to make sure we get clear skies. The Northern Lights originate at an altitude much higher than the clouds, like when we're on a plane and see the clouds beneath. So if you can't see the stars where you are, you need to move to a different spot. That's where we start. Forecasting is 50% of success.
Yeah, our forecast today is okay. We have some chance of seeing the Northern Lights. So we're going to keep our fingers crossed. Because I know that some people in Norway believe that if you wave a white handkerchief outside, that will summon the Northern Lights. Do you have any rituals or lucky charms, Alexander, that you believe will bring them on? I can't help but notice you have a little Cheburashka here.
That's right.
I see your lucky charm.
Yes. Exactly. His huge ears, like antennas, help me hunt for the Northern Lights, and I go in the right direction. He's my lucky charm.
Okay, well, I'm glad that he's with us.
I usually rely on science, but
when that fails.
But there are some rituals as well. If we've been waiting at a spot for a long time and nothing is happening, I ask our guests to join their hands and say the Northern Lights in Sami, Gufsahas. We join hands, crouch and go Gufsahas. We stand up and say Gufsahas. We jump and Gufsahas. It's like a circle dance that gets people excited. It creates a fun atmosphere and time just flies until we see the Northern Lights in the sky and everyone is overwhelmed with joy. For me, it's a ritual that helps me bring the group together and cheers them up. Sometimes, if you have a busload of 40 people all waiting for the Northern Lights that never appear, and then we go to another spot, but again, nothing. All of them begin to give me doubtful looks, like, do you even know what you're doing? And then I start praying, like, where are you? Please. Sometimes it's a matter of pure luck, of course.
Of course, yeah. Well, let's hope that luck is on our side today, Alexander, and then we'll see them.
Even when all our ducks are in a row and we expect a good result, you still need a little luck, because something can always go wrong.
Wow.
And you were right. Your forecast was right, Alexander. We get to see the Northern Lights. Hurrah!
Hooray!
So, and this is the perfect time to ask, how do the Northern Lights occur? We have particles that are ejected from the sun, they hit the Earth's atmosphere, and we see this wonderful display. But that's a very simple way of putting it. Can you explain in a bit more detail, please?
Certainly. You're right. This is radiation from the sun. Radiation is both waves and particles. When it reaches Earth's atmosphere, the gases in the atmosphere begin to glow. The physics behind it involves the loss of electrons, etc. But simply put, we could imagine a fluorescent light bulb that's filled with gas. This gas represents Earth's atmosphere. When we send the current through the tube, the light bulb emits light. The Northern Lights operate on roughly the same principle, only you have solar particles hitting the atmosphere. There are notable differences, though. Earth has a magnetic field that is generated by its rotation. It creates both electricity and a magnetic field. The purpose of the magnetic field is to reflect back all cosmic rays, including those coming from the sun. Otherwise, there would be no life on this planet. However, when the magnetic field of the sun, which reaches our planet in the form of radiation, and the magnetic field of Earth interact, particles accumulate in the magnetosphere and manage to get through above the polar regions. So the atmosphere glows, CO2, oxygen, hydrogen, and the other atmospheric gases.
And what determines the color of the light itself?
That's exactly what I'm talking about. The color depends on which gas is interacting with solar radiation. Each gas, each molecule, each atom has its own spectrum. So that's what determines it. Most frequently we see green northern lights because, if I'm not mistaken, it's oxygen that is typically involved in these reactions. However, there are some other beautiful and rarer hues, purple, yellow, red, and so on.
Is it true that some people can actually hear the Northern Lights, the static electricity? I mean, I can't hear anything now, but do some people actually hear it?
Yes, I've heard these stories, but scientists say the Northern Lights produce no sound. Besides, they occur at an altitude of 35 to 300 kilometers. That's very high. We wouldn't hear anything anyway. Probably it has to do with the fact that moisture crystallizes in very cold air, so what we hear might be the crackling of ice crystals. But let it be another mystery.
Well, unsurprisingly, many northern peoples have a lot of
myths, legends and beliefs around the Northern Lights before they could explain them with science. One of my favourite ones is Greenland, that they believe it's a sort of a football match between dead souls with the skull of a walrus head. Are there any local myths or beliefs here in Murmansk, or were there any back then?
I'll make a joke, if I may. The biggest myth is that the Northern Lights appear when it gets really cold. In fact, there's no connection whatsoever. We can see Northern Lights even in late August, because they're only a result of solar activity. But, jokes aside, the story that impressed me most has to do with how the Sami people used to see the Northern Lights. They believed they were a portal into the world of the dead, the netherworld. That's why Sami avoided looking at the Northern Lights. They would hide in their dwellings waiting for the aurora to go away. It was a matter of respect. Nobody would come out to enjoy the view, the souls of their deceased ancestors. According to another impressive story, there's a fox running through the sky. When its tail touches the snow in the sky, it begins to sparkle. A beautiful one, isn't it? When we observe this beauty, all tales seem real.
So in the past, some people believed, obviously, that the Northern Lights were a sign of impending doom or disaster. Of course, we know that not to be true. But what effect did the Northern Lights and these coronal ejections from the sun have on Earth now?
That's a great question. Indeed, in the past, the Northern Lights were sometimes seen as a bad omen, a sign of doom. Fast forward to the 20th century, when Chuzhevsky, a celebrated scientist, lived in Russia. He believed that all solar activity had an impact on Earth and claimed that all social processes on our planet, including epidemics, wars, migration patterns and so on, were governed by the sun. When the sun is active, something happens on Earth. When the sun is passive, things calm down on our planet. This theory hasn't been proven, but it's an interesting one to think about. Let's consider it an unsolved mystery.
Well, Alexander, thanks so much for taking me on your hunt for the Northern Lights, and it was a success as well.
You're welcome.
Thank you. So how about we just stand in silence for a bit and enjoy this fantastic display?
With pleasure.